sight. Caterpillar to a butterfly.
It's Green and Growing with Ashley Frasca.
Plants, flowers, trees, and stuff.
On 95.5 WSB.
Green and Growing, coming to you straight from Midtown Atlanta this Saturday, the weekend before Thanksgiving. Welcome to the show. Glad you are here. I spent all of October doing special segments with Seth Hawkins of the Georgia Forestry Commission and talking about the wonderful things to do in North Georgia, including the leaf color, which now sadly has peaked. However, I put my money where my mouth is, and earlier this month, some girlfriends and I went up to enjoy the wineries in North Georgia, particularly in Dahlonega, and I ran into the owner of Dog Hobble Wine Farm in Dahlonega, Sam Zamaripa, and he was so gracious in spending time with my group, and I could really tell the passion for the wine farm. It includes so much more than just wine. There's alpacas, there's donkeys, there's chickens. There's a grove of 14 different varieties of pawpaw trees. And I think I could learn a lot from someone like Sam, small business owner, really big into plants and sustainability. So I had to steal a quick conversation with him, and I learned something about him right away.
My real claim to fame, Ashley, is that I'm a long-term listener of the Walter Reeves program. I have been interested in Georgia gardening most of my adult life, both as an amateur and now on some scale, because we own two fairly large vineyards in the Georgia region. And in some ways, we think of our vineyards as just big gardens.
That's very true. And I will say, some girlfriends and I are out, beautiful fall weekend here in North Georgia, in Dahlonega, visiting Dog Hobble. First of all, explain the name. The significance of the name kind of blew me away because as a gardener, I did not know.
Yes, it's a fun story. And the gardeners that are listening today will know that there's a wonderful plant that's used as an evergreen plant called Lecothoa fantasia. Some people call it Lecoth. It's very popular in North Florida, but it's abundant in the Atlanta region. It's an evergreen, a stalky bush that in the spring has a lovely cascading white flower that is very fragrant. So for gardeners that are creating screens or creating areas for an aromatic floral garden, Lecothoa is very, very popular. However, in the wild, Lecothoa is slightly different. It doesn't grow as tall. It grows in large clumps, almost like a rhododendron or a mountain laurel, big thickets with stalks like bamboo, very stalky, waxy leaf, again, evergreen. But in the wild, and by the way, the wild includes all of Appalachia.
Okay.
In the wild, it's known because the folklore is that when bears are being pursued by dogs, that the bears will navigate towards the fields of Dog Hobble because the dogs cannot get through it because it hobbles the dog.
Perfect.
Yeah. So in the country, you'll hear people talk about Dog Hobble. Unknown to me, by the way, when we first arrived here in this region in the Dahlonega area, someone said, well, I looked at the plant and I said, that's Lecothoa. He said, no, that's Dog Hobble. And we thought that was just a wonderful name and a wonderful story that would be a foundation for a vineyard here that we operate today called Dog Hobble Wine Farm. And we chose that name because not only was it local, but it spoke to our commitment to sustainability and to growing vines that are from this region and that can all have their own folklore for being part of the region of North Georgia.
Well, and correct me if I'm not pronouncing it right, but the culture of growing vineyards and wines and all that, viticulture. So the fact that you're trying to establish native vineyards and native wines and grapes in the area, what are some of the ones that folks would recognize that are native to North Georgia?
So we're not alone in the movement to grow what are called sustainable vines. And really what that means is to grow vines that are from the region. They're cold hardy, they're heat tolerant, they're disease resistant, a number of different things that make them suitable for the Georgia region. In this area of Georgia, we have what is called the Dahlonega Plateau. And the Dahlonega Plateau is a viticulture region. The Dahlonega Plateau is to this area what Napa is to Northern California. So we have a region that's designated as a great growing area for a certain type of vine, certain types of grapes. And we are only growing those kinds of grapes here. Again, they're grapes Some people will know them if they're familiar with grapes from the Eastern Seaboard. Norton would be the most famous. However, we also grow something called Lomanto, which is increasingly popular, and a white wine called Treminet. So there's several varieties that people are increasingly familiar with. And, you know, in the same way that people now drink craft beers from their local area, people are beginning to drink craft wines. And we specialize in those wines.
Agritourism is so important to our state, and especially to the areas of North Georgia. If someone were just trying to grow just a few grapevines, one of my listeners just maybe wanting a small 15-foot strand or something, what would you say are one or two of the biggest challenges? Because you mentioned disease resistance. Yeah. That's huge with our climate, with our humidity and all of that. What are a couple of the challenges you face?
Well, the reality is that there are a number of grapes that you can grow very successfully here. Not all of them are perfect for making wine. Some of them are. I would encourage everyone to go native and to embrace muscadine wines. Earlier, we talked about some wines that are native to this area, and I mentioned Carlos, which is a muscadine wine that is unusually dry. It's almost like a Sauvignon Blanc. So I would say go find some Carlos, which is easy to locate at any number of garden centers that have native grapes. Grow that. It grows abundantly, it grows easily, and does not require herbicides or pesticides.
And if you have questions, you get in touch with your county extension agent, who would be happy to help you with different varieties to consider. And Sam, I want to give you an opportunity to, you mentioned the sustainability piece, and as a business owner, it's very admirable that you have the consideration for that. What are some of the things that you've done on the property of Dog Hobble that keep that sustainability piece in mind?
So we only grow native grapes. There are no European grapes here at Dog Hobble. The grapes that are here have been cultivated, grafted, cross-pollinated, and are certified for growing in our region. So that's number one. And there's 7 acres of those grapes. That's thousands and thousands of plants. We also grow here native persimmons. So we have an orchard of persimmons that are actually lovely this time of year in the fall. And then the most important thing that we've done, which we think is a real interesting undertaking, is we have 170 pawpaw trees.
Most native Atlantans and Georgians know that, but for someone who does not know what a pawpaw is, explain the fruit.
So pawpaw is one of the most remarkable fruits in North America. And pawpaw, at one time in the colonies, everybody had a couple of fruit trees in their backyard. They would have a blueberry bush, they might have a fig bush, an apple bush, but they would also have pawpaw, because pawpaw was indigenous to North America. It came from Native Americans. And so people knew pawpaw. When apples and pears and other fruits became commercially viable and they all had shelf life, pawpaw lost out because it does not have shelf life. You have to eat it immediately. So it literally disappeared from the American culture, and it only reappeared 50 years ago due to the work of a wonderful botanist in Kentucky named Neil Peterson. And today, the pawpaw category is the fastest growing native fruit category in the United States. And here at Dog Hobble Wine Farm, we have 12 varieties of the Neil Peterson pawpaw.
And what do you do with them?
You eat them. They're absolutely delicious. They're sometimes described as a cross between custard and mango. They're absolutely fantastic. People adore them. We have fruit every year now. So when our customers come in pawpaw season late in September, we introduce them to the fruit. We let them taste it. And they all want to come back and try it again.
Sam, I have a feeling that with your history with Walter Reeves, we could have an extended interview. So I will make that happen, I promise, in the spring. But for now, this is just a teaser. Let folks know how they can learn more about Dog Hobble.
Well, just visit us. Visit us here in North Georgia this fall, this winter. It's a wonderful time of year to be in North Georgia. Our wines are all here. We're here 7 days a week. We have wonderful food. And if you come, chances are we'll be here. Dog Hobble Winery. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and all other social media.
So for this, do you promise a longer interview with me?
Absolutely. Delighted. And I hope that Walter will be listening.
I know he will. Thank you for your time, Sam.
Thank you so much.
I had a great time visiting with Sam. And who's thirsty? Okay, it's early. It's the 6 o'clock hour. I will stick with my coffee. Well, it's really interesting how passionate Sam is about the pawpaws. But if you want to know a little bit more about persimmons, yes, there are many native to Georgia. You can grow them here. Native persimmons are actually known to be cold hardy to temperatures of 20 to 25 degrees below zero. You know we're not playing with that. Native persimmon trees that are selected for planting here can reach a height of about 30 to 40 feet within the landscape or the garden. Oriental persimmons grow a little bit shorter, but you have to have space for them. They need full sun. And when do you get to enjoy them? Well, now. That's a Georgia-grown product. You can start enjoying them as early as September, peak being this time of year, but all the way through December. Look them up. They're pretty cute little fruits. They remind me of tomatoes, especially when they're growing on the tree, kind of orange in color. And the more ripe they are, the better. When we come back, it is the top three things to be doing in the landscape this weekend. Stay with me here on 95.5 WSB. The update on this weekend's weather brought to you by Finley Roofing.
Green and growing. Ashley Fraska's top three things to do this weekend.
All right, number one, the National Audubon Society boasts a great list of important bird foods that they need now as the colder weather arrives. We can put out suet, black oil sunflower seeds, and mealworms for bluebirds. Also, peanuts, a great source of protein. Check out the list on my Facebook page if you are a birder. Number two, keep leaves out of the base of flowering shrubs like hydrangeas, perennials. I've got my Rosa Sharon that the leaves are finally falling down into. The buildup of leaves and moisture trapped at the plant's crown can lead to rot and disease, and you'll want to use a gloved hand when removing debris. And I also had somebody ask about what I said a week or two ago about rose bushes. If you have trouble with black spot on the leaves of your roses each year, it's a great idea to rake those leaves out from under the rose bushes, put fresh mulch down, and you'll at least remove the fungal spores from the scene. That way they don't overwinter and affect the bush next year. And number three, speaking of mulch, it is so crucial going into winter. You may think your beds don't need it, but they do. You add fresh layers to garden and flower beds. You can even use a huge stack of dead leaves. But nonetheless, all of that can help retain soil moisture, provide insulation, and cut down on weeds. Following up on my previous conversation with the owner of Dog Hobble Wine Farm, you can find great places that are agritourism stops in the city of Atlanta, in North Georgia, places where you support Georgia Grown. All of this is from the Georgia Department of Agriculture. The website is georgiagrown.com, and it's an amazing website. When you click on agritourism, you're running out of ideas of things to do. What about the colder weather? This website really helps point you in the right direction, from finding Christmas trees and pumpkin patches, though we are moving past that, to farm tours, gardens and arboretums, state parks, and even some of those wineries, distilleries, and breweries, both inside and outside of the city. Again, visit georgiagrown.com. Well, when we come back, I have for you a previous conversation from just a couple of weeks ago with UGA turfgrass specialist Dr. Clint Waltz, covering some really common questions from you this time of year about things related to your lawn. When we come back on Green and Growing.
Is always greener on the other side. Caterpillar to a butterfly.
It's Green and Growing with Ashley Fraska.
Plants, flowers, trees, and stuff.
On 95.5 WSB.
Welcome back to Green and Growing. I am away this Saturday, but if you missed my conversation with Clint Waltz just a few weeks ago, kind of busting some myths or maybe misunderstandings about what to be doing to lawns right now. We really break it down between warm season grasses, the ones that are going into dormancy, and cool season grasses like fescue that are going to stay green throughout the winter. Here's an update from my guest, UGA turfgrass specialist Clint Waltz. Now, is there any want or desire or need to hurry? The lawns would go into dormancy quicker. Is there any urgency for that, or it just happens when it happens and it's okay?
It happens when it happens, and it's okay. And quite honestly, for the grasses that we just mentioned, those warm season ones, the longer that happens, and if they're retaining some green color, they're photosynthesizing longer. And those environmental cues are telling those plant as it's making the sugars, translate those or move those down into the rhizomes or the storage structure. Mm-hmm. So the longer this happens, the more of that's stored up, and the better our reserves are for coming out next spring. So typically, we'll see a better spring recovery with a longer fall transition.
Okay.
Because you've had opportunity to spend. You've mentioned a couple of times this morning about translocation or moving of herbicides for things like English ivy and poison ivy.
Mm-hmm.
Same kind of things happening here. It's taking those environmental triggers. So if you do make that cut and then you follow it right behind with a glyphosate or a triclopyr type of application, that plant is already in that trigger mode of move resources down.
Down, right.
And that's right. It's doing that, and that's why those are a little bit more effective. But likewise, the sugars that are being made in our grass are being stored back in those rhizomes for Bermuda grass and Zoysia grass below ground that help it to actually persist.
I like this conversation very much, and I want to make sure that we get from Clint knowledge to put things to bed, so to speak, the lawn, put it to bed healthy and happy. That way you're coming into spring green up in the healthiest condition you can. So what does that mean? Well, you know, preventing disease, pests, all those kinds of things. And common questions that I've received from all of you over the years, I want Clint to answer. What is the best shade tolerant first grass variety when we're looking at just fescues, Bermudas, centipedes, Zoysias, St. Augustines, for people that may not know, best shade tolerant grass? But then if you're going to name one type, if there's a specific variety of that.
For the Atlanta area and North Georgia, Griffin North, if I had to pick one that's going to handle greatest amount of shade, it would be tall fescue. Some of these Kentucky bluegrasses, now I can recommend, because we do have a sod producer that's growing Kentucky bluegrass, and you can get it as a vegetative material. Both of those would wind up doing really well in the heavier shades. And as far as it goes with individual cultivars, I don't recommend individual cultivars of tall fescue. There's just too many of them, too many variabilities that go into it. I try to travel around and check the Home Depots and Lowe's and flip the bags over and see which cultivars in them. And what I tend to find is any of the tall fescue blends that are out there have got two or three that have done reasonably well in my plots in Griffin, in our research trials in Griffin. So what's on the market out there is very acceptable. So without endorsing or naming any specific cultivar, tall fescue blends that are on the market are really pretty good.
And is soil prep that much more important in a shady area, or it's just
absolutely
important overall?
It's important overall, but absolutely. You know, it still kind of boggles my mind a little bit, and that our horticultural friends out there, they'll do everything they can to dig the hole when they're planting a tree twice as wide and twice as deep, or do everything they can to till their soil before they plant their tomatoes and squash and this, that, and the other. And soil prep tends to get very much overlooked when it comes to grass. It's just throw it down green side up. So, but soil prep's every bit as important for turf, whether you're planting seed or sod. We're still talking a plant here that wants to grow roots in that soil as deep as it can, and wants a favorable environment to grow those roots in.
Soil test depth. For providing the soil for that test for lawns, is it about 4 inches deep is sufficient?
Inches. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So see, you think the roots then go down that deep. The soil is important that far. You're not just talking about the surface.
That's correct. The deeper you go, the more you dilute things out. And a majority of the roots in turf are about 4 inches. And the other is when we start talking about doing the tilling and that kind of thing, most of your commercial equipment can't till much deeper than 4.
Right.
So, and I've had to correct a few things through the years of some old extension publications, a till to a 12-inch depth.
Yeah.
Ideally, that sounds great, but the
reality,
there isn't the equipment that gets down that deep.
Good God.
So, you know, if we're going to do anything, let's
halfway to China at that point.
Exactly.
That's deep.
I mean, but that's a heck of a tiller that would wind up getting 12 inches below the soil surface. That's, most tillers just don't go that deep, but they can get down to 4.
And mentioning shade-tolerant grasses to consider, Clint there saying tall fescue, and I'll talk about the sod producer proudly, NG Turf, with multiple farms in the Atlanta area. NG Turf kind of introducing to homeowners the bluegrass blend. So they've got Sunbelt Blue and Southern Blue, which are cool season grasses, alternatives to fescue. Cold hardy, remain green all year round, though, just like fescue, may struggle in a dry, hot summer. But those two, bluegrass, the Sunbelt Blue and the Southern Blue, really well known for their performance in shade.
They are. Dr. David Jesperson on the Griffin campus did some work with those a few years back, and they actually did very well for him after 2 or 3 years in the shade environment. So pretty dense shade. You got the two cool season grasses of Kentucky bluegrasses, and the tall fescues are options. But even then, there are times where it's too shady for even those grasses to persist. So there needs to be some sunlight getting through that canopy down to it.
Well, like you said, it is a plant after all.
That's right.
So if it's a plant, it needs sun.
And another question I get sometimes from folks when we start talking about shade plants is, well, how will it do in the sun? All of our turf grasses prefer full sun. It's just a matter of which ones can tolerate the stress of shade and to what degree.
There you go.
So some of these can tolerate that stress of shade better. So like I said, I get some homeowners say, okay, that sounds fine in the shade, but what about where it goes out into the full sun? Same grass will do just as fine out there. It's going to do better out there. It's still there, as my granddad would say, it's still there holding the world together, but that's about all there is to it. The canopy density changes between the two of those. So it's going to be there even for the tall fescue, the Kentucky bluegrass. The deeper the shade, the more canopy is going to open up relative to what you would have out in the full sun.
Is now an appropriate time for people to be thinking about fungicide applications on the lawn?
It's environmentally, fungi are just really loving this time of year. You can go out to your big box retail store. There's several granular or a couple granular fungicides that are out there. The active ingredient on one of them may be azoxystrobin. I think that may be on
Does it start with an A?
It starts with an A.
Okay, good.
A-Z-O-X-Y-S-T-R. I think that may be a Scotts product. And that has about 28 days of residual. So you can put that down. It's going to last for about 28 days. So if you have Bermuda grass, Zoysia grass, well, Zoysia grass, Centipede grass, St. Augustine are the ones I would primary on that one. You can put it on Bermuda too or tall fescue. And then there's another one out there, bioadvanced, and that's got propiconazole as the active ingredient. And that one's going to have about 14 to 21 days of residual, which right now that's probably all you need because next 2 to 3 weeks after that we'll get cold enough and the diseases won't be a problem. So both of these go out as a granular. Look for the products that are just fungicide only. There is one that's on the market. I saw it as well. It's got a fertilizer in it as well. It's a Scotts product as well, but it's got a 19% nitrogen with it.
We don't
We don't want that on our warm seasons. Now, that would be fine if you're tall fescue or Kentucky bluegrass. That would be fine. But if on our warm season grasses, that combination product of fungicide and fertilizer, not on zoysia grass.
Now,
not on centipede or St. Augustine. The
knot
needs
to
be.
Grow.
That's right.
So when we're talking about fungicide, it's always preventative. So
correct.
When we put that on a grass that's going dormant now, are we preventing fungus from happening in the next few months, or is it going to hold and really make it healthier for spring?
It's going to prevent any disease from happening now. And it's just kind of being a preventative or prophylactic type of application for right now. And this should get us through this fall and winter.
And then it'll come out of dormancy in the spring.
We're trying to make sure it's healthy going into dormancy. That way it's healthy coming out of dormancy.
That's okay. That's what I was getting at. I like that. All right. More questions for Clint Waltz. We'll be talking about a winterizer. When you see that at the big box stores, what is that? And also pre-emergence herbicide. I talk about that in September. Is it too late to do it now or is it still beneficial? All of that when we return next. That update on the weekend weather brought to you by Finley Roofing. For a free roof analysis, visit finleyroofing.com. Now, when you come in studio, want to ask the questions that are on the minds of listeners. What are some of their most common concerns or just things they don't understand? The bags that I see in the big box stores that are labeled as winterizers, you think, okay, well, I must have to put that on my lawn to get it ready for the winter. Explain what's in that bag.
For warm season grasses, it's a bad thing.
Okay.
For our warm season grasses here in November, we don't need them. Most of those do contain a fairly decent amount of nitrogen to them. So our warm season grasses, we talked earlier about the environmental triggers. They're taking those. They're slowing their growth rate down. So we don't need those fertilizers. As a matter of fact, we get a little bit of, if we were to stimulate growth, it's more susceptible to disease. If we're sick going into dormancy, we'll be sick coming out. So one of the things that we can do to abate that is not over-fertilize or over-stimulate them. So our cool season grasses, tall fescue, and the Kentucky bluegrasses, if anybody has those winterizers will be fine. This would be the ideal or proper time to put those down. If you're sitting on a zoysia grass lawn in Alpharetta, you don't need the winterizer. I'll save you some money right now. You don't need the winterizer fertilizer.
What's the concept of a winterizer? Like, what is it doing to the grass?
It's got a little phosphorus and potassium in there, well, and the thought there is we're stimulating root growth. But and that would be all fine and good if that first number was zero.
Nitrogen. Yep. No nitrogen.
But that first number, that nitrogen, is not zero on most of these products for us on warm season grasses. So I would have no problems if somebody wants to go out and, based on a soil test, needs a little phosphorus. Most of our soils tend to be deficient of potassium or that third number anyway. from a stress management type of thing, as well as some disease abatement, potassium helps there as well. So while we still do have root activity, potassium right now would be fine on warm season grasses. So if that winterizer was truly a winterizer for warm season grasses, it would be pretty much a zero analysis on nitrogen, a little bit of phosphorus, and then a moderate to higher load on the potassium side for warm season grasses. That might would actually help improve winter hardiness of our warm season grasses.
Yeah.
And then be true to name or true to form. But that's not the case.
No. So winterizer, stick with just tall fescue, bluegrass, using that now. We talked about fungicide before. That's good for any and all grasses right now.
Correct.
To prevent fungus from either happening in the cool season grasses or preventing a warm season grass from coming out of dormancy and potentially having problems. Another product, a pre-emergence herbicide. So it's the weed killer, weed preventer that we use to prevent the next season's weeds. And we talk about, you know, around September 15th or prior to, get that done. Well, here we are in the beginning of November. And what if someone's looking at their lawn being like, I remember last winter I had a bunch of weeds. Oh my gosh, is it too late to prevent those?
In general, it's probably too late for, at least for annual bluegrass. The fact that we haven't had a lot of rain in September and October.
Not to interrupt you, but annual bluegrass, totally different than us talking about Kentucky bluegrass, a turf, a desired lawn. Annual bluegrass, a weed, also known as Poa annua. Correct. That's what we're talking about here. I don't want people to hear bluegrass and be like, wait, they're talking about it good and bad. This is not a good one.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just generally considered a weed. I often refer to as the cockroach of the weed world.
Yeah.
I know it's been it's already germinated. I've seen some around. It's been a little slower and delayed this year. Again, I think some of that's back to the lack of rainfall we've had in September and most of October. It should start to germinate now a little bit more rapidly. That being said, your pre-emergence herbicides have to go down before you have germination. So if you didn't get it down, it may be a little late for that at this point. There is an option out there. There's a product that has dithiopyr in it, and I know I'm using the chemical words, but you got to look at the labels on these products for two reasons. One, to know what you're buying, and then the other is read the labels so that you know how to use them correctly. But if it has dithiopyr, D-I-T-H-I-O-P-Y-R, and that is on the homeowner side, you can find that in a granular carrier. That's a herbicide that has some what we'd like to refer to as reach back. So if the weed is very small, 1, 2, 3 leaf stage, it can wind up acting a little bit as a post-emergence as well. So it can kind of reach back and kill very small weeds, so those that have just recently germinated, the dithiopyr product, and it will give you then some pre-emergence activity. So if I were to put out anything right now, November 1, based on the weather we had in September and October, I would use a dithiopyr-containing product such that I get a little bit of reach back on small weeds and then protect me going forward the next 2 to 3 months.
This Poa annua, annual bluegrass, really, I mean, we'll see it through the wintertime, but I recall seeing it most and being plagued with it, like, by March, April, it's still hanging around.
February, March, that's right. That's when it really explodes. So
yeah.
Those environmental cues, air temperatures and soil temperatures start to warm back up about mid-February. The daylight's more and more daylight every day. That little annual bluegrass plant goes from dime size to quarter, half dollar size.
Yeah.
Almost a matter of 3 or 4 days at that point. And then, yeah, then that's when people go, ooh, I don't like it now.
Yeah, right, right.
And at that point, it's almost too late. It's pretty hard to kill at that point.
Oh, it's mixed in the turf quite well at that point. So, yeah.
But right now will be the time to go after it. So even if it's a little small plant now and it stays a small plant for the next 60 days, it will get to be a much bigger plant later on if you don't do anything now. So now's the time to really go after it.
And most of these rapid-fire questions I've had today for Clint Waltz can be found on my website as well as a blog. So go to wsbradio.com/greenandgrowing and find the article there. Excited for hour number 2 of Green and Growing. When we come back, my interview with former U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, a Georgia governor held that position for 8 years, Chancellor Sonny Perdue, up next.